You're live.
Welcome to the Church of Mavis radio show. It's Friday night, 7:17 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, 8:17 p.m. Eastern. Running a little late. Had some technical stuff, but it seems to iron out, so I'll just blame Mercury retrograde. That's what I usually do when that's happening, if it's K-Tube, but we'll do that. You're listening to United Public Radio, 107.7 FM, New Orleans. And make sure if you heard the intro, that was Gulina from Retro Agogo. They did a new intro. They're about to do us a YouTube commercial. So she's cool. Kind of like an Elvira type character. And if you check out retroagogo.com, they have lots of what they're doing pretty much. Doug Pagosh, who was on the show, an artist. He does a lot of like Universal Monsters and stuff like that kind of art, or the monsters and stuff like that. But they got these masks that are from like 1960s Halloween, and they redid them and recasted them in their own style, and they enlarged them, and they're selling them. And there's like a NASA radioactive zombie. There's like Creature from the Black Lagoon, Dracula, Frankenstein. They look really cool. You can go there and check them out. They just did a Mars Attacks one. That's pretty cool. A lot of people put them on their walls.
But they look looking really at their cool. Website right now.
Yeah, check out those masks.
Yeah, those masks are great.
I had quite a few of them hanging up. I bought a bunch of them. I'm like crazy. I'm like addicted to them.
they're great.
I just got a Bride of Frankenstein that's coming. They did that movie London After Midnight. I think it was Lon Chaney, about Jack the Ripper, that was like some lost weird kind of horror movie back in the day. They did that one. That's on there. There's a bunch of different ones, but who else? Creature from the Black Lagoon, The Mummy. They look like those old Halloween things. They're great. They're really unique. But that's retroagogo.com. And let me see, one last plug here. Asian tea is kratom.com. Asian tea is kratom. Asian tea is used by people all over, from everything from pain relief to anxiety to sleep or good energy. It's 100% organic. Product's not been evaluated by the FDA. It's not intended to treat, cure, diagnose any disease or illness. Life is better on Totten Bay. And what about that eclipse coming up? Everybody's going crazy over that. I saw these.
Oh, yeah.
I was looking through these YouTube videos because I was putting up articles for the audience where I work at Before It's News. And there's all these preachers saying, like, I'm not knocking them or anything, but they're basically saying it's the day of judgment and tying it into the return of Christ. And. Which maybe they're right, but probably not. but the people are going crazy about the eclipse for sure. I even saw an article today that's tying in the government to it, using it to do stuff to us, like some kind of vast conspiracy, like the government's harnessing its eclipse power is going to turn us into zombies. But who knows? I mean, it could be happening. I know there's a lot of importance to it. We've discussed that with the Native American tribes saying that's important, and
yeah.
Jewish folk. But the Christian side is definitely saying stuff, too.
Our guest, Stephen, isn't that your birthday?
Yes, it is.
The 21st? Yes, it is.
Nice.
A happy birthday on your and you're going to have this miraculous, wonderful eclipse.
Well, I hope so. I hope it's
Steve, what is your astrological sign?
Leo.
Okay, so it's in Leo. The eclipse is in Leo. That's what
it's barely Leo. It's like the 29th
right
degree
the
Leo. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Steve, it's great to have you here. Really enjoyed your books. I have the Lock, and I have this one. I'm pretty sure I have a couple others, too. You've just done so many great books over the years, and it's great to have an author on, because we can talk about your new book. And then, of course, I like to ask writing questions as well. So I'm kind of curious, what got you started on Undisclosed? I mean, it was a big leap. Usually you write books about sharks and, you know, Meg and things like that, but aliens, it's a pretty big leap. So how did that come about with Undisclosed?
Well, that's a good question because, excuse me, 3 years ago, I was given access to testimonials from members of the military, intelligence services, defense contractors, NASA, the FAA, regarding secret black ops programs called USAPs. USAP is an unacknowledged special access project that is so compartmentalized, even the people working in them, they don't know what they're about. And the most guarded USAPs involve UFOs, extraterrestrials, secret subterranean bases, and zero-point energy, which is a free, clean energy source that was purposely black-shelved and was reverse-engineered from these down interstellar craft starting back in 1947 with Roswell. And what actually convinced me, see, what happened was is Dr. Stephen Greer, the foremost authority on extraterrestrials, had read one of my books and wanted to meet me. So 3 nights before we were supposed to be scheduled to meet, my wife and I were driving home from a dinner and a movie on a Saturday night, and we're looking up in the sky over our neighborhood, and there's these lights coming over us, about 8 to 12 of them in staggered pairs, and sure enough, it was UFOs. And they were silent, they were majestic, they were amazing. And as we watched, they moved off into the northern sky and just disappeared into the ether, into a higher dimension. And then 3 nights later, I met with Dr. Greer, and of course, the first thing I said was, you're not going to believe what happened to us. And he kind of smiled and said, that happens a lot with people he's meeting for the first time. Because these higher intelligence they communicate with thought energy, and so he said they were checking you out.
So any Disclosure Project and all that, have you sat on any of those kind of panels or anything yet with anything, or is it just the book was the launch of your UFO career?
Well, Dr. Greer had some important information he wanted to get out. And so what we agreed to over the coming months was that I would ghostwrite a book for him, which came out as Unacknowledged. And in exchange, he would give me the access to not only write his book, but write a thriller, Undisclosed, which is essentially a Trojan horse. It includes the same information woven into a story, because a thriller is often an easier way for people to disseminate the information. And take it in bite-sized, digestible bits. And so that's what I did. I created a story out of all these facts, things that are pretty mind-boggling. And, so the story of Undisclosed takes place in real time. In the year 2017, Donald Trump is president, and we have a gentleman who's a former Iraqi Apache pilot who's the hero of the story, and he's been put in position as the Undersecretary of Defense for a reason. He doesn't know it yet, but they chose him because they want him to get these black-shelved energy technologies into the public arena. And so that becomes his task, and the book picks up from there.
It's always great when you have people on that are from the military. For instance, Robert Salas has been on the show. You know, he wrote his book about the silos and the UFOs. I've had different other people over the years. And it's always John Vasquez. He's passed away now, but from the Fort Benning episode. But anytime you have someone on like that from the military, it's like UFOs in your face. Here you go. If you don't believe it, you know, it's pretty reputable. These guests who are ones that I know of that have been on the show, to have them in your face about these subjects. And, I mean, it's just such a vast amount of info. And, you know, that incident at Fort Benning, are you familiar with that case at all with John Vasquez?
Yes.
That's
in Unacknowledged.
Yeah, that case, man, that was creepy. It gives me the creeps. It's definitely And then, you know, John had spoke to me several times before he passed away, and he was still doing, you know, research for that case, and something about a sergeant or something. And then next thing you know, I don't know exactly how he passed away. I think heart stuff, but it was just all kind of creepy. He was always on the tail of that case, and he would call me and tell me stuff, and I'd be like, yeah, it's creepy. I don't know if you'd be telling me this stuff. But God rest his soul, John Vasquez, definitely miss him. He was great for sure. But so how did you decide to put the information from military sources into a fiction book to work it in? What was the process for that?
Well, the first part of the process was I had to go through hundreds of hours of testimonials from insiders in the military and intelligence organizations and places like that that had witnessed these UFOs or had worked in these super secret black ops programs. And once I had all that information down for Unacknowledged, Dr. Greer's book, I put it all in a historical content. So the book opens up with Foo Fighters, which were these sort of energy drones that were involved in World War II. They would shadow the bombers on both sides of the war, the Americans and the Germans, and in the Pacific, the Japanese as well. And in some cases, they would fly in formation in front of the military craft, and other times they would shoot across the sky at fantastic speeds. Other times they would actually move into a higher dimension and go through the ship, go through the airplane, the bomber, and which would freak out the crew. But they were called Foo Fighters because that translates in French into fire, and also in German, and of course the rock group took their name. But these were real things, and the reason that they were there, and this is what I find so fascinating about the actual testimonials, is because they weren't randomly there. They were there because we had sort of set off an alarm in our galaxy that the humans on planet Earth have figured out how to split the atom, which is, I guess, the equivalent of a teenager learning how to play with fire and matches, or gasoline and matches. And so when we detonated the test atomic bombs and the ones over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that brought them to our planet in droves. And then Roswell, the reason that Roswell happened was because Roswell was actually an Army Air Force base that was the home of the 509th Bomber Squadron, which was the only wing in the world equipped with atomic weapons. And so in June of 1947, there were three of these interstellar craft buzzing Roswell. Now, Roswell was equipped with a scalar weapon, which is a longitudinal wave that moves faster than the speed of light. So when the Army Air Force Base hit these three interstellar ships with the scalar wave, two of them collided and went down, and the other went down over a farm several hours away and wasn't found for 2 years. But of the two ships that collided in Corona, New Mexico, there were a number of bodies, which were about 4 feet tall, these gray bodies, and there was one that was still alive. And the dead bodies were taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and the surviving extraterrestrial was taken someplace else. And so all this information is in the book, but, you know, from there it goes into present day, all these interactions between these extraterrestrials, which were really here because they're concerned that we are going to kill ourselves with nuclear weapons.
So the Foo Fighters, you definitely think those are extraterrestrial entity, but I mean, there's just so many other different theories and stuff, but what makes you think it's completely extraterrestrial?
Well, besides the eyewitnesses, Eisenhower had sent General Jimmy Doolittle to investigate these things, and he came back with a report that said that they were interplanetary in nature. General MacArthur I was also experiencing the same phenomenon in the Pacific, and MacArthur organized something called the Interplanetary Phenomena Research Unit, which still exists today, and the Army denies that it's an official organization investigating UFOs, but in reality, that's what exactly they're doing.
Definitely interesting the way those things came out during that. And of course, when you're talking about aliens coming because of radioactive stuff, I was thinking of Twin Peaks, but that's what just happened sort of in the new Twin Peaks. But was it at when they left the bomb off in Twin Peaks, like Nevada or Mexico or something?
He was depicting the Trinity test and you know, which was the first explosion of test explosion of nuclear weapon, and then used that as a means by which to show that by doing that he basically had sort of opened up a doorway to another realm, you know, the realm of the Black Lodge, and that let the dark minions come in, basically.
That was an episode, because that was episode 8, and that was so good. And then throw in Nine Inch Nails in concert. I can't get any better than that. But go ahead, Wim, if you want to jump in with some questions.
Oh, well, Steve, you mentioned that the aliens or the extraterrestrials or whatever are concerned about are destroying ourselves by nuclear weapons. And I guess the question that comes up for me is that why? I mean, are they just benevolent beings, or do they have some relationship to us? Are they connected to us in some way, or, you know, why would they, you know, take on that kind of concern when there's a whole universe out there?
Well, it's a good question. I can't say for sure, but there's a lot of indications that maybe life was seeded on our planet, and we mm-hmm. have hieroglyphics and artwork and things like that indicate that we were visited by, you know, many species of interstellar beings, higher intellects. The Mayan culture has recently was announced that the Mayans had artwork and that indicated they were visited by, you know, craft that looked like flying saucers. And so, but what really brought them in droves was the nuclear testing. Because in 47 we had the atomic bomb, but we were also involved in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, and both countries were racing to complete their tests on the hydrogen bomb, which was far more devastating. And so all these tests, and there's, you know, what's amazing, you don't realize it, but over the years there's probably been about, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 different tests.
Worldwide, yeah. Yeah, the United States has tested over 1,100 or so.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, the numbers. And you know, people think, well, okay, well, there were only two bombs that went off in Japan, but that's not true. They've been testing somewhere underground, somewhere in the ocean. And these higher beings, they know that it's going on, and they buzz these Air Force bases, and they've actually shut down ICBMs in the silos. And they've actually taken down ICBMs that were launched into space. And at one point, we tried to put nuclear weapons in space, and they took them down. And all these testimonials from the people who worked on these projects, because they want this information out there, they spoke to Dr. Greer, and Dr. Greer gave the information to me, and I incorporated it into Undisclosed. And it's, you know, it's things that I never knew. Well, most of these things I never knew, but fascinating things like that there are structures on the moon that are extraterrestrial bases on the far side of the moon, and that mm-hmm. NASA knew that they were there, and when Apollo 11 was landing, they had filmed B-roll of the landing in a soundstage just in case the extraterrestrials decided to show up. And sure enough, they did. And they had to go to the B-roll for, you know, different splices. The B-roll contained footage of the American flag. And in the B-roll, they had made a mistake because the flag was moving. Well, there's no gravity on the moon, so it shouldn't be moving. So, you know, certain people picked that up.
You mean there's no wind on the moon? There is gravity on the moon.
There's no air,
otherwise,
so there's no wind.
Yeah, there's no air, yeah. So I haven't heard that version of the story that the moon landing actually occurred, but there was also this extra thing that was going on the side. I was just saying to splice in so that,
yeah,
you know, if the aliens showed up, then they could go to the other, they could go to
the B-roll
that was going on in the studio.
Yeah.
So that means that the existence of that B-roll is the source of where people think the whole thing was faked.
Correct.
Okay.
The moon landings did happen, but the B-roll was spliced in to cover up the E.T. who were in the background.
Has anybody seen the film of the aliens in the background?
Yeah, but I mean, there are people at NASA who were involved in the Apollo landing have seen it, and they were, you know, not sworn to keep it secret. They were basically threatened: if you come forward with this, we'll not just kill you, we'll kill your family.
No.
I mean, there were the two major reasons that Undisclosed and Unacknowledged were written and just came out had to do with two major secrets that were divulged. One is a false flag event that is in the planning stages that we're trying to stop from happening by exposing it. A false flag event is an event that makes it look like something is happening, but it's really being perpetrated by, you know, in this case, a faction of the government.
Right.
And they have, when they reverse engineered these UFOs, they were able to build man-made versions of them that operate the exact same way almost. You could not tell the difference. A layman couldn't tell the difference between a real UFO and a man-made one. And the reason that they're doing this is because the false flag event, which several eyewitnesses testified about, would make it look like Independence Day, the movie, that we were being attacked by aliens, when in actuality we're being attacked by our own military defense contractors, the military-industrial complex. And they would do that to sort of keep us in a perpetual war and empower them to take over. I mean, it's crazy, but...
And this is something that has been in the planning stages for a while.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And they keep them in these subterranean bases that are under, you know, like, were constructed several miles underground beneath a military bases. And in Undisclosed, we give... the location of these bases, the names of them, and certain descriptions of them. But the second reason, and the more important reason, that we came forward with this information and wove it into a story has to do with zero-point energy, which is the technology that's used to power these craft. Now, Nikola Tesla was the first human who discovered this back in the early 1900s, in fact. Tesla, in 1901, was preparing to use the planet's own magnetic field as a giant dipole in order to broadcast electricity to ships at sea without using any wires. And that, it's an experiment that, had he been successful, and he would have led to free energy and have changed the world. There'd be no fossil fuels. We'd have zero-point energy. But what happened was J.P. Morgan intervened, and J.P. Morgan was a wealthy industrialist, and he had invested in copper wire to use in homes and businesses for electricity. And, you know, totally out of greed, J.P. Morgan decided that giving free energy to the people was un-American. So before Tesla could conduct his experiment, Morgan got his cronies in Washington, D.C. to shut it down. And they confiscated all of Tesla's papers and inventions and left him destitute. And this is a pattern that repeats itself throughout history. Every scientist who has ever figured out how to tap into the zero-point energy field has either been shut down or silenced by the powers that be. And you have to understand, it's not enough to just invent a zero-point energy device, which is clean and free energy. You also have to sell it to the right people who won't quash it. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to be able to get it done. And the other thing is that you need a patent to protect your invention. And therein lies the second problem, because Section 181 of the U.S. patent law allows the government to arbitrarily determine if a technology or device poses a danger to our national security. So over the last 100 years, we've had rogue elements within the Defense Department, the CIA, the NSA, the Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Energy, that have basically abused this interpretation of the patent laws, and it refused to grant patents to these inventors. So you've got guys like T. Townsend Brown, who was the founding father of electrogravitics. He discovered that if you use zero-point energy and hook up a high voltage, say 200,000 volts to it, it would charge the capacitors and cause the vessel to lose its mass. So in other words, T. Townsend Brown invented the flying car. He could levitate the car or the craft off the ground. And that's what these UFOs use, these higher intellects use. Well, Big Oil wasn't too keen on the competition, so they shut Brown down and denied him a patent and confiscated all of his work. And this goes on and on and on and on.
So is this tendency to destroy free energy, is this something that is done simply for the sake of capitalism by a few humans, or is there some kind of nefarious power behind these folks?
Well,
I mean, humans are quite capable of their own greed. I mean, you know.
It's a matter of greed, and it's a matter of power, and you know, that, I mean, it's sickening, because it means a few very greedy individuals are keeping 7 billion people from creating energy devices that would basically eliminate poverty, eliminate hunger, eliminate climate change, remove, you know, basically reduce and remove pollution from our air and water, save our oceans, and create millions of new jobs in new technologies. You know, it's basically, it's the equivalent of, you know, replacing the typewriter with the word processor or the computer. But they don't, but the word processor company, or I'm sorry, the typewriter company says, no, we don't want you to replace our typewriter, so we're not going to allow you to have that invention. And that's what the oil companies are doing. These CEOs of these big oil companies are using their money to make sure that the people that control these things don't bring them out.
Well, just the reason that I ask is that there are some people, you know, in the UFO community or UFO connected conspiracy communities that maintain that this whole project to keep most of the world's people down, you know, and the few people in certain key corporations and power, that there is a force behind that. In other words, it's not just human greed. There's like another alien race behind that. Like for some of them, it's the reptilians, or, you know, there's various theories about all that. And so that's what I was asking about, So you're just attributing it to human greed, which, like I said, is perfectly large on its own. Doesn't need a lot of alien help to make it work.
Yeah, I don't agree with the reptilian thing. I mean, I've heard things like that before, but it's basically humans, and it's what happened was in 1956, Eisenhower had set up this agency, which became known as Majestic 12, to handle all these things,
mm-hmm.
and they did. They kept everything a secret, but over the years, the military-industrial complex within MJ-12 sort of rose to power, and they decided that, we're not going to share the information with the president anymore. We don't think he has a need to know. And over the years, the name of MJ-12 has changed from Majestic 12 to C-Corps to PI-40. Now it's known as MAGIC, M-A-J-I-C. But it's become the largest RICO, the largest racketeer-influenced and corrupt organization in the world. And Dr. Greer has acquired testimonials from people on the inside. And 70% of the people involved in MAGIC actually want the world to have zero-point energy. The problem is the other 30% who are sociopaths like Dick Cheney, and they control some very frightening weapons. One is a scalar weapon, which was actually used to scare off President Obama in 2009 when he was looking into the UFO issue. He and his family were in Norway to accept the Nobel Prize, and the cabal basically launched a scalar weapon in Norway that was like a warning to the president. Basically, we have the ability to take down Air Force One, so, leave this alone. And if you go to YouTube and you search for Blue Spiral over Norway, you'll actually see it because it was witnessed by 10,000 people.
Yeah, I've seen the picture of that. It's pretty remarkable.
Yes.
It is. Pretty remarkable.
They of course shoved it off that the Russians had tested something, but that's not what happened. That was the cabal, that magic group.
Hey, Steve, what are you hearing about the eclipse? Are you hearing anything about that at all, or is it all hype? What are you hearing about it?
No, it's pretty much assured that it's a natural phenomena.
Yeah, I've seen all kinds of things, but definitely being hyped up. I think someone told me it's been 100 years. How long has it been? Has it really been 100, or is that
true? I think 99.
That's a trip for sure. It's been so long. I remember some kind of eclipse when I was in elementary school, but I don't think it was this kind, but that's 99 years. Wow, that's something else for sure.
You sound pretty good for a 99-year-old.
Nosferatu. Nosferatu. But I'm 42 going on 99.
I do want to mention to any of your listeners out there who are interested in reading Undisclosed that if you purchase the book in hardback, and it's only available in hardback and ebook, but if you purchase a hardback and email me the receipt, and my email is actually in the book, I'll enter you in a contest to be a character in my next thriller. So if you want me to see your name in a book and a character developed about you yourself, purchase a hardback of Undisclosed in the month of August and email me the receipt and send me a little bio as well, and I will I may end up making you a character.
Nice. Steve, the show ends, and we're going to take an 8-minute break at the end of the hour, and then got about 50 minutes left. What are you comfortable doing? Are you good for the rest of the show, or do you need to do a little less than that?
No, I'll do whatever you guys want.
Okay.
Cool.
We'll take the break. We'll take the break coming up, and then we'll keep you for the rest of it. That'll be great. I thought your writing career is definitely very inspiring, and been reading about it. What was your first book? my dogs are going crazy. My brother's letting them out, so they'll be done in a minute. Go ahead.
My first book is Meg, which was about the 70-foot megalodon prehistoric great white, and that's the one that they're making into a movie that'll be out in August 10th of 2018, starring Jason Statham and Ruby Rose and Rainn Wilson and a great cast, international cast.
So Jason Statham in a giant shark movie, that should be good. Yeah, I like this movie. It definitely got the action going. I ain't no doubt about that. That's pretty good. So when you first wrote your book, what did it take you to write it? Were there obstacles you had to overcome? Did you have discipline trouble? Or was it something just said? Like for me, it took me like 10 or more years to write a book. I told you when I talked to you earlier. And then when I was writing a book, I didn't even know I was writing a book when I was doing written interviews. Is this something that you talked about a lot? Or is it something you just said, hey, I'm going to write a book one day. And next thing you know, you're doing it.
No, it was pretty deliberate. What happened with me is that, you know, I was struggling in a number of different jobs. In August of 1995, I had read a Time magazine article on the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest, most unexplored part of the ocean, 7 miles down, about 1,440 miles long, 40 miles wide. And the article talked about hydrothermal vents and new life forms. And I had always enjoyed reading books about, or articles and books about great white sharks, and there was always a blurb about Megalodon. And so I sort of married the idea that what if Megalodon was in the Mariana Trench? Maybe that's why we don't know if it disappeared or not. They went deep. And so I spent 30 days in the library doing research and wrote the book from 10 o'clock at night till 3 in the morning and on weekends. And on Friday the 13th in September of 1996, I went to work and found out that I had been laid off. And so I went home with no money in the bank and a family of five to take care of. And I said to my wife, honey, this is the best thing that could have happened to me because now I get to start writing my second book. And she about hit me on the head with a frying pan. And 4 days later, Meg went out to the six biggest publishing houses and buoyed by the fact that we had a first book deal at Disney's Hollywood Pictures, sold for quite a bit of money.
Did you just say you wrote a book on a weekend?
No. I wrote the book at 10 o'clock at night and on the weekends.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant like one weekend. I was like, damn.
You're
a Nick Redfern.
he writes the way he did that the way I have to write, which is like in between my two jobs and after work and, you know, stuff like that. You know, the book that I just published, that's how I wrote it. You come home from work and you sit up for 3 hours and write, you know?
Yeah, and many nights I fell asleep on my word processor.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you set a goal and you believe in what you're doing and then you make it work. And, you know, I was able to do that. You know, if, you know, people ask, well, how do you write a 400-page book? And the answer is a page at a time.
Yep.
And Steve, what about that? One of my weak spots is punctuation and all that good stuff, editing. Well, how are you with that? Is that something you do on your own or you get a lot of help with it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I wasn't an English major or anything like that, but I read a lot, so I understood punctuation. But, you know, once you're done writing your manuscript, you can hire an editor to do those things for you, or the publisher will hire somebody to do it.
I can spell really good with punctuation. I don't know what, I missed the boat on that one.
Well, that's what an editor's for, Jeffrey. I mean, geez, you know, it's such a nice,
I should be able to do some of it. I should be able to do a little bit of it. I can do periods. At the end of the sentence, that's about it. It's my Georgia. But nonetheless, well, what time is it? We're waiting for a signal from Joe here. And so has there been any talk about any kind of movie situation with this book?
You never know. You never know.
We need more good alien stuff. One of my favorite documentaries ever is that Dan Aykroyd UFOs Unplugged. I love that one. That was a really good one. Dan Aykroyd just telling you about UFOs and chain smoking, which I'm sure I don't smoke, but he was chain smoking while he talked about UFOs. If you've never seen that one, that's a good one. Another one of my favorites that we had, Christo Ruppolo from a documentary, I believe it's still on Netflix, it's called Curse of the Man Who Sees UFOs. If you haven't seen that, check it out. He drops the F-bomb a lot, but some of the footage in there, I mean, he's basically in California and he takes his camera to everywhere where he's at, and the stuff in the sky that he gets on that footage, it's amazing. We've had him on the show. If you've never seen that one, Curse of the Man Who Sees UFOs is really good too. We're going to go on break. Everybody, you listen to United Public Radio, 107.7 FM, New Orleans. What's your website, Steve?
www.stevealton.com.
All right, that's stevealton.com. We'll be back very shortly, and we'll finish out the rest of the show.
back.
Welcome back to the Church of Mavis Radio Show. You're listening to United Public Radio, 107.7 FM, New Orleans. Just real quick, I'm going to go over the guests, a couple of guests that are coming up, and then we'll get back to Steve. Next week is, let me get to my list here. Gail Bietti. I love how I try to mess up her name. I'm trying to say Betty. Gail Bietti. And Debbie Ray.
Gail it's Beatty.
Bietti.
Beatty.
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 Like Warren Beatty.
Beatty.
Like Warren Beatty.
Yeah, like Warren Beatty. Got it. Got it.
That's right. They have a book about kids and Bigfoot. So we'll talk about that. September 1st, Rebecca Genesis. She has got a book called Ghost Seer. September 8th, Bill Shutt. He's got a book, Himalayan Codex, and a cannibalism book. So we got to talk about that cannibalism book. I originally got him on for the Himalayan Codex, but then I found out he had a weird cannibalism book that's like the history of cannibalism. And I wrote that publisher, and so I'm doing a double kind of book combo there. I definitely want to get into both of those books, but that cannibalism book is crazy. I mean, it's real scientific. It's creepy. It's really creepy. Richard Estep and Vanessa Mitchell, they got a paranormal book. Devin Hunter, that's some Littlewind witch type book. September 29th, Don Webb, Judah Page, that's the set book. October 6th, Beazle, that's his book, his paranormal book. And Don Webb's coming back for H.P. Lovecraft. And then Ron French is coming back. I got to talk to Ron French. He's in the alt-right stuff. I'm not sure if he's involved in it, but I'm going to keep my eye on him. So he's going to be on Ron French. I'm sure that'll be interesting. A mess. A train wreck. October 27th, Nick Sullivan. He wrote Zombie Bigfoot 1 and 2, and he's on Boardwalk Empire with Steve Buscemi. He's a lawyer or something. But we're going to talk about that, how it was to be on a Boardwalk Empire, which was on HBO, a mafia show. At least Scorsese, wasn't it? I think so, yeah. Jeff Mudge's show's been on American Ripper by H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper Connection. I'm not sure how I feel about that, but the show's really good. And they seem to think there's a connection, but I know there's a lot of controversy about that. If H.H. Holmes was Jack the Ripper and vice versa, I don't know. But definitely a creepy show. But last I heard, Martin Scorsese was supposed to make Devil in the White City with Leonardo DiCaprio as H.H. Holmes, which, if that's true, that's going to be terrifying. That Holmes story just related to that guy. He's like the Chicago murder hotel killer and all that stuff. Crazy. But let's get back to Steve. And what book hit New York Times bestseller, Steve? Meg?
There were four. Meg, The Trench, The Shell Game, and Primal Waters were New York Times bestseller. And Domain was an international bestseller.
What's it take to hit New York Times bestseller? It's just the amount of books sold, right? I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah, it's a strange sort of configuration, but what it comes down to is selling a certain amount of books in a given week to get on the list.
And what about The Lock? I have that, but I need to read it. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and we'll get back into Undisclosed? That's just Loch Ness Monster, like a thriller around Loch Ness Monster, right?
Well, it's a little bit more than that because when I was first asked to suggested to write the story, I turned it down because I thought it was kind of silly. And then I met with a cryptozoologist who had spent a lot of time at Loch Ness, and he shared his theories about what the real creature is in Loch Ness. And when I read his work, I changed my mind. I said, "This is really amazing." Because these are not some kind of prehistoric creature. These are actual marine life that were, one of them was caught in Loch Ness when they started using explosives to build the the roadway in Loch Ness around the Loch. And when one of these creatures got caught in it like 70 years ago, it has an anatomical functions that if it doesn't leave the Loch to breathe in the Sargasso Sea, it doesn't die. It's the act of giving birth that kills it. So it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And so that's what the Loch is about, the real creature.
I have it. I'm going to have to read that one pretty soon for sure. Me and one of the reasons why I do this show is because when I was young, around 17, I went through testicular cancer and I had to go through chemo. And at the time, it spread to my stomach and lungs. And I was 17 and, you know, I had surgery. I lost one in the war, so to speak, at 17. And then I woke up and told it spread to my stomach and lungs and you got to go through chemo. And I went through it. And during that time, I was in the comic books and I said a prayer to be a superhero. And I thought I was going to die. So I was like latching on the comic books and the Anne Rice books and stuff, anything to escape, you know, that reality. And anywho, a few years, I've been healed. I rarely ever get sick now except for occasional. Sometimes when I go out in the sun, I get sick or if I get a cold or something. That's about it. But I can go out in the sun, but sometimes lately during these summers here in Florida, I go out there and get the wind taken out of you. It's like the Amazon out here, you know, because you're not too far away. But anywho, I said a prayer to be a superhero, and several years later, my dad died, and then I went through a divorce, and I started reading a lot of books on anything I can get my hands on, and I was in Georgia and Hampton. And something I did opened up doorways, and I had a lot of UFO sightings with multiple witnesses from my mother, my brother, my sister, to friends. And on some level, it was like I was attracting them. And I even had friends look at me and say, Jeffrey, you're attracting them. And, of course, I've seen some beings. And the big thing for me was just overcoming the fear of why me? Why the hell is this happening to me? Because, I mean, you really... And there was times where, I mean, I'm still sometimes afraid to go out of my house, but back then I was even more like that. But that's why I do the show. I made a forum to discuss this stuff because I was like, what the hell happened to me? So all these people start talking to me about the subject and everything. And the next thing you know, I started doing these little chat interviews on my website. And I was in the heavy metal and stuff. That's why the Mavis Nostradamus stuff. It was kind of like an Alice Cooper, you know, Black Sabbath kind of thing. And then it took off, and now I'm like, maybe I shouldn't have used that name. but nonetheless, here I am, still using that crazy name that nobody really knows what it means. A lot of people speculate it means Antichrist. Nobody knows what it really means. He never really says what it means. There's all kinds of interpretations of what, you know, Mavis means. But nonetheless, I attracted experiences, so I started doing the show. That little chat room thing evolved into a radio show. And some of the beings that I've seen little bitty cloaked beings standing around a black box with a witness, my friend Brian. And it was in my house in Georgia, and we were like, do you see that? And he was like, yeah, do you see that? And we were like, we both see that. And my cat saw it. And it was like these little bitty hooded beings standing around a black box. Now, I know Stephen Greer is a controversial person, and you know, I've heard all kinds of different things about him. I don't really have any problems with him, but I work at Before It's News, so all that information, and I put up a lot of his stuff, positive stuff. But when I saw that little body of that little bitty alien, which I know there's some controversy with that, but it kind of clicked in my head, like, was that what I saw one day? Because that thing looks about the same size as those little hooded things. Because I know he had that little weird alien. I don't know if it was a mummy or what it was. I don't know all the details.
Right, that was in his movie, Sirius.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, did I see those little things? Because that thing looked like what might be under those cloaks. No possibility. But another type of being that I see all the time are light beings. And I see them all the time. Like, I have experiences where I can look off the back porch here and look into the heavens, and it's like I see into a quantum realm, and I see those beings. And I've seen two leave my house here. So I attract stuff all the time, and that's why we do the show. And Wham, has, she could go on and on about it as well. I'm kind of curious, have you had any personal experiences, or is that something that you want to have, or how do you feel about that, or have you had any?
Well, like I said at the beginning of the show, I had one. My wife and I had one 3 days before we were supposed to meet for the first time with Dr. Greer. And, you know, it was an incredible experience. I mean, these things are so majestic. And, you know, you're looking at these things flying over you. And then they disappear into, you know, they just, I say the ether, but they're moving into a higher dimension. And, just amazing.
And yeah, and what's so strange about it is when you see one, I compare it to taking a drink from the Holy Grail. And many times when I've seen them, it's like they know you see them. And that's the part that you have such trouble dealing with. There's this thing up there that knows you see it, and it's there kind of because it's for you on some level. So that's the thing that I struggle with. You know, the why part of it. But, you know, apparently Stephen Greer talks about communicating with him, so I'm sure he's had a lot of experiences more, you know, as he talked about or from what his research about some of his personal, like, experiences he's had where he's interacted with the beings. Has he gone into it? What do you know about that?
Yeah, well, his situation is that when he was young, he had a sighting. And then when he got a little bit older, he had a similar situation to you. He had septus from a wound, and he actually had a near-death experience. And when he passed into, you know, the higher dimension, you know, he had sort of a conversation with a higher being, and was given a choice to come back and finish his work or go on, and he came back. But what that taught him was they were communicating with him through thought energy, not verbally. And he realized later that this is what extraterrestrials are able to communicate. And when he was a medical doctor, he was he started leading these training called CE5. CE5 is Close Encounter 5, where humans initiate the contact with extraterrestrials by sort of having a meditation circle outside and using remote viewing techniques to channel their thoughts into the heavens, and so that any ship that was passing by, the ETs would be able to overhear this thought energy, and the thought energy was basically vectoring them into the place where the CE5 event was going on. So I think it was in 1991 or 92, one of his first events was in Tampa, and on the beach in the ocean, and they actually vectored in three huge ships. And the Tampa Tribune picked the article, you know, wrote an article about it the next day, and the next thing you know is Greer's being asked to come to this meeting in Atlanta, where waiting for him at this meeting were members of the CIA and other agencies and Magic 12. And they basically said, you know, you don't have, what do you think you're doing contacting these, you know, these extraterrestrials? And he basically said, you know, screw off, you know, I'll do whatever I want. You know, you don't own the right to communicate with other species. And he was about this time, it was in 92, and Clinton was just elected. And when Bill Clinton was elected, the first thing he wanted to know as when he, after he was sworn in, was who killed Marilyn Monroe, who killed JFK, and what's going on with Area 51? And so as he tried to get this information, he realized that he was being shut out. So he was introduced to Dr. Greer through some members of his administration. And Lawrence Rockefeller, who was a supporter of Dr. Greer's, and things went on from there. Greer was briefing a couple presidents and members of Congress, but he also realized that nothing was going to happen working with politicians, that he had to, he had to make his own inroads.
What about there's a being you speak of in here, and I've seen a lot of articles lately about the praying mantis type aliens. Are those similar to the Greys, or is that a whole different species, so to speak, from them?
That's a different species, and I had attended a CE5 week event in Vero Beach with Dr. Greer, and I think it was the second or third night. We were up late till like 3 a.m, and then when I finally went to bed, the windows, we were staying at this beach house, and the window treatments were no longer there. And so Dr. Greer had brought these aluminum sheets that were used to cover up the windows so that we wouldn't wake up in the morning when the sun came in. And I was lying in bed staring at the window, and I realized there was somebody looking back at me from the other side of the window, and it was this, I mean, this is going to sound bizarre, but it was this huge praying mantis head, and he was looking at me, and I was looking at him, and, my thoughts were very calm, that this is a friendly being, and he's being friendly toward me, and I'll be friendly to him, and I sort of passed on the thought, thank you for coming, and this went on for about 15 minutes, and then finally I turned the TV on.
Oh, man. Went
to sleep.
The praying mantis thing creeps me out, man. I'm sure it was good, but just the whole, just that it is a praying mantis is enough to creep me out.
Well, I mean,
yeah.
Think about it. We are, Homo sapiens are, we sprang from primates, which is, a pretty violent species. And insects are a pretty cooperative species. So even though there's the ugly factor, the praying mantis are a lot kinder toward their own than primates are.
Probably. That wouldn't surprise me. One person that you mentioned here is a controversial figure, Robert Bigelow. I've heard all kinds of, from the positive to other opinions about him. And one of my big problems with him is that Skinwalker Ranch. That's like one of the most interesting places on the earth. And I love that book by George Knapp, and I forget who else, but The Path of the Skinwalker, I think that's the name, but it's the Skinwalker book, The Hunt for the Skinwalker. But the fact that they came in there and just like closed that place down, and now we don't know what the hell's happening there. That's my problem. That annoys me, but I'm kind of curious, what's your view on Bigelow? How's he fit into all this? Geez.
Well, I'm trying to remember, was that unacknowledged? Or undisclosed?
Oh, undisclosed. You mentioned aerospace. He's the aerospace guy, the Robert Bigelow, and you mentioned him in Undisclosed. I was just looking at it. I had it in my keywords. He's definitely in here, Robert Bigelow. He bought up Skinwalker Ranch, and they, set up all the cameras there and stuff and had all kinds of crazy stuff happening.
Oh, right. That's right, yes.
Jacques Vallée went there, I think. There's all kinds of stuff.
No, I think it's, the people who provided that information wasn't Bigelow. It was members of the military and who were, keeping an eye on him and got to know him. So, that's a pretty amazing segment of that chapter on Unacknowledged.
Definitely. And I'd love to know what's going on at Skinwalker Ranch. That place, you've heard of that, right? Skinwalker Ranch, I'm sure. You've heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some high weird going on there. If you've never read the book, Hunt for the Skinwalker? Yeah. It's a George Knapp wrote it, but that's a really good book. It's all about that place, and the natives won't go there, and you know there's Bigfoot and aliens. There's all kinds of crazy portals, and it's a really really wild place. Wynn, you want to jump in? Let me breathe. I'll catch my breath.
I like to hear accounts about the praying mantis beings, because I mean, I haven't had any experiences like that, but when I was doing my research for my master's degree on alien abduction or alien contact stories, one of the women that I interviewed for that project, she told me the first praying, this was years ago, this has been like 20 some years ago, she told me the first praying mantis story that I ever had heard, you know, and I heard it from her first, and then later on I heard about it from other places, you know, and she talked about how this praying mantis being would appear periodically in her bedroom. Like she'd wake up in the middle of the night and there'd be like this praying mantis being, like this giant praying mantis, like in her room. And of course, to me, that just sounded terrifying, you know, because I think of praying mantises as predators, because that's what they do. And she said, and so I remember asking her, oh my God, you know, how do you deal with that? Because that would just freak me out. And she said, you know, you'd think it would, but they emit this incredibly loving energy. You know, they're
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. Yes.
You know, and it sort of causes you to, it sort of overrides that sort of automatic repulsed fear that, you know, I guess would be a primate response. Something like that, you know. And
well,
I just found that remarkable.
You have to, I guess, you know, part of the reason that I wasn't freaked out was because, you know, I'd spent the last couple of days with Dr. Greer and listening to his lectures all during the day and then doing the CE5 at night. You know, we're here to communicate with these higher beings, and the higher beings want to communicate with us, and you know, when you realize that they're here to help us and not scare us, you know, it you have a different attitude toward it, and I think that's what helped me a lot. I mean, if I hadn't have gone to that CE5 training and you know, woke up in my bedroom and there was a giant insect standing there, you know, that, I'm sure I would have been freaked out. But once you're prepared, once you're you realize that, you know, all the life in our universe is all connected, you know, by a spark. We call it the soul, and the soul is immortal, and you know, when we pass on, our souls continue on, and we all have the spark from the same creator, and whether it's an extraterrestrial or somebody in living in Afghanistan or wherever it might be, you know, we're all connected, and what we have to do as a species is stop the violence that we're creating, because, you know, we actually have the ability now to quote the former CEO of Skunk Works, we have the ability to take ET home. What that means is we have the ships that can fly across the galaxy. The only thing is we've been quarantined. And until we learn to treat each other with respect and stop killing each other, these extraterrestrial species are not going to allow us to leave Earth space. So, you know, and there's a reason that the Apollo missions ended, and that's because they didn't want us there. And that sounds kind of strange, because John F. Kennedy challenged us to go to the moon. But the truth of the matter is, it was a Cold War competition between us and the mm-hmm. Soviet Union, and was military by nature because of the competition. And so, you know, when I read that it sort of made a lot of sense.
So just recap for me, because I don't know. I don't think I caught it all. So the various extraterrestrial / alien creatures. Part of the reason I say that is because I'm not sure that I really like the term alien. You know, alien
Dr. Greer says that alien is sort of like using the N-word.
Yeah, I mean,
they prefer extraterrestrials.
Right. Well, it's just sort of rude. It's kind of like, I mean, if, as you suggest, they have sort of a stake in what's going on here because they, you know, they're connected to us or they, you know, they help to seed our life here or whatever, then in some ways they're our relatives or our ancestors, you know, they're part of our family. So it doesn't make any sense to call them aliens. But that's why I say the / aliens, because some people still use that term. So of the various, has Stephen, because you'll have to remind me, I haven't read any of Stephen's stuff for a couple of years. I've been reading other things. But how many alien species does he concentrate on that are contacting here? I mean, extraterrestrials that are here, that are contacting us and...
Well, in the testimonials that I read, the number varied anywhere from 12 to as high as 34. They only have the remains of, I believe, 4 different species
okay.
that their ships crashed because of these scalar weapons, and you know, the bodies were taken to Wright-Patterson, but
right.
You know, they have I think there's an insect species, there's a reptilian species, there's a species that looks human, except the faces are more gaunt, more narrow, and something different in the eyes, and
mm-hmm.
I think they call them Nordics.
Yeah.
And then there were 2 different species of greys, the 4-foot ones and some larger ones. And one of the witnesses had said that one of the greys was actually a biological drone that the greys had created for whatever reason. So, all that's woven into the storyline and undisclosed. And it's
right.
unacknowledged as well.
Right. And all of these are more or less interested in us, benevolent to us?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I think one of the things that sort of puts this in perspective is that there's 3 type of civilizations that have been characterized by scientists. There's a type 1, a type 2, and a type 3, and the type 3 is the highest, and they're able to travel across the galaxy and, you know, communicate with different worlds and things. And when you reach a type 1 or type 2 or type 3 society, you sort of live by, you know, live and let live rules that you have to, in order to access this information and put it to use, you have to have sort of an understanding that life is precious and we're all connected. You know, warlike species don't reach higher levels of civilizations. Now, what we are is a type 0 civilization. We're at the point now that we're either going to become a type 1 civilization and be able to travel, you know, through space and into the stars and use zero-point energy, or we're going to kill ourselves. And
mm-hmm.
whether it's nuclear war or climate change, I mean, you know, I know some people out there don't believe in climate change, that it's all some, you know, left-wing plot, but it's absolutely 100% true. And what the book gets into, Undisclosed gets into, because this is one of the plot lines, is that when you raise the temperatures on our planet, even by 1 or 2 degrees, which doesn't sound like much, you start chain reactions with the poles, polar ice. And it's the polar ice in the North Pole, you know, around Greenland, that when that ice melts, it inundates the North Atlantic Current with fresh water. Now, the North Atlantic Current is this warm water conveyor belt of warm water that moves around the planet through the oceans and basically keeps our planet from moving into an ice age. It mm-hmm. keeps, you know, Europe warm. It warms the North American continent. And if the polar ice melts, that will send enough fresh water into the North Atlantic Current that will stop the current from moving, because it moves because of the saline in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And if that happens, we will have an almost immediate ice age that could last hundreds of years, thousands of years. And that's it for us. We're done. So, you know, climate change is a definite threat to our species. And, you know, it's not a political issue. It's a survival issue.
And so this is one of the things that
the
extraterrestrial beings, yeah. Are they helping? Is it that they're trying to get us to change our ways, or are they also working with planetary systems to try to mediate some of this issue? Because I've heard that from some corners.
I can't honestly say, but the advent of zero point energy would save us, because the reason that we are heating up our planet is because of carbon dioxide as a byproduct from fossil fuels. So if we eliminated fossil fuels, we would eliminate pollution and eliminate the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere
that's causing the planet to heat up. So I hate to ask you a real political question here, but is this current administration kind of an issue with regards to this all getting done?
The short answer is yes. And it's interesting that you asked me that, because last night I couldn't sleep. Something was weighing on my mind, and I realized that if disclosure is going to happen, and if we're going to take on zero point energy and force it to come out from the shelves that it's been, you know, been kept quarantine, it's going to take a unique type of president to do that. And I'm not a Trump supporter, but I realize that, you know, he is right about certain things. One thing is the fake news. I mean, it sounds ridiculous when he says it, but the truth of the matter is that we have eyewitnesses that came forward and basically corroborated the fact that the CIA has representatives in every part of the mainstream media. And the CIA determines what is going to be printed or talked about or not, which is the reason that Dr. Greer can't get on any mainstream TV, because they won't allow it. It's the reason that major articles aren't written in the New York Times and the LA Times and the Washington Post about UFOs sightings or theories and things like that, because they won't allow it. So by that interpretation, it is fake news, because they're not allowing freedom of the truth to come out. And when I started realizing this, I got up out of bed and and went up to my home office, and I started writing a letter to Donald Trump. And I sent him a couple copies of the book today, and just to alert him that these things. Now, I don't know if he'll do anything about it. I don't know if he can get the book, but you know, I just felt like, you know, maybe this guy is just independent enough to not care about what the fossil fuel companies think. But then again, he's got a bunch of oil people on his administration, so.
Right.
But
right.
I definitely disagree with his climate change views. I think that's, and then there's the other thought that you know, in order to make change, you sort of have to wait for the pendulum to swing wildly to one side or the other to get it to swing back again. And since Trump's been president, you know, you have a lot of protesters and people demanding, you know, for change and those type of social movements, you know, haven't been really seen since Vietnam.
Right. Yeah, he certainly has united a lot of people against him in various ways. That's very, very true. He kind of galvanized people, actually. But that's, that, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I don't know what I think about disclosure, because people have talked about disclosure for so long. You know, I mean, I've been doing research and about UFOs, and have been connected with UFOs for probably 40 years. And, you know, ever since I was, before I was a teenager, because I had a sighting when I was 6, a very important sighting, and wasn't the only member of my family, it turned out. I didn't know it at the time, but I wasn't the only member of my family that was having experiences. And, you know, people have talked about disclosure for years. I mean, off and on. And so I, you know, there's a part of me that's like, you know, I don't know if it's ever going to happen. I'm sort of, you know, I'm sort of cynical about it. What do you and Stephen Greer feel about this? Do you feel like eventually it'll just sort of have to happen because the situation is going to become so grim here on the planet? Or do you think it might happen in some other place other than America? Because I know that other countries have some of this information too.
I think that that's definitely a possibility. I think that, you know, the purpose of writing Unacknowledged and Undisclosed was to create a tool that provided the facts. And so that if we got it into the mass market, which it is, you know, it's in all the Barnes and Nobles, and it's on Amazon, of course, but, you know, it's in major bookstores across the country. But that would be a good first step, that people could get the information out. The tough part is to get the word out. But every person who purchases a copy of Undisclosed or Unacknowledged or both is increasing our chances for disclosure, of increasing our chances for stopping climate change, or increasing our chances for getting these free energy sources out there, like zero point energy, that can change the world. So, you know, I call it the butterfly effect, that, you know, if a group of butterflies can, their wings flapping in Africa, can create a dust storm that creates a hurricane that moves across the Atlantic Ocean, then a group of readers, you know, reading the same material, can create a movement as well. So that was the idea, and now we just have to get, you know, shine the light on it, get people to look at it. And your show tonight helps in that effort, because everyone listening to
right.
the show, you know, hopefully they'll purchase the books. And I'll give you, anyone listening to the show, I'll give you a money-back guarantee right now. If you buy the book, Undisclosed, you don't like it, I'll give you your money back. So, but I know it's the information is important, and I know it opens a lot of people's minds to it.
I guess my big thing. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask one more question. So do you consider this book, Undisclosed, to be one of the more important things that you've done in your writing?
I consider it the most important.
So you have a lot more invested in it in some ways than your previous books.
Well, absolutely. And I, you know, I go back to that sighting 3 days before I was supposed to meet Dr. Greer. That didn't happen by accident. That was an event that was supposed to happen. Because if it didn't happen, I wouldn't have been committed enough to write both of these books, because it took 3 years of my life. And I wrote it on spec. In other words, I didn't have a contract to write it. I wasn't paid. And it cost me a lot of money. I had to go through all my retirement savings. I had to borrow money from my mom to keep going. So it was, if I don't have that experience with my wife, you know, as these ships passed over us, I don't take on the project. They couldn't afford to.
Right. And so that, I mean, that's just a myth that I've kind of gotten the sense as you've been talking, you know, looking at your previous work, that this work here is sort of a watershed for you in some ways.
Yeah, the only thing that I compare it to is when I wrote when I wrote The Shell Game. Which is about the next 9/11 event and extrapolated information from the last 9/11 event, which was the false flag event. And I had threats writing this book of fiction from different sides of the equation. I was getting calls at 4 a.m. on my unlisted home phone.
Wow.
With threats being made on me. And it was about that time that I started having symptoms of Parkinson's. And that was about 11 years ago, and, you know, it's been a struggle. So, you know, you do pay the price sometimes in the choices that you make. But, you know, sometimes you got to do what you think is the right thing.
Right, exactly.
Well, hey, Steve, who's A&M Publishing? Is that you or is that someone else around here? I said, that's Florida, A&M Publishing, Florida.
Yeah, A&M Publishing is my company. I'm one of six partners. We actually opened the company 2 years ago because I had reacquired the rights to Meg and knew it was going to be a movie. And so Undisclosed is the first book that I've written. It has come out as a hardback for A&M Publishing. And it's one of the reasons that Dr. Greer went forward, because he knew that A&M Publishing would not edit him as far as changing his information, whereas a major publishing house would probably change a lot of things, and that's why he's never gone with a major publishing house. This is the first book of Dr. Greer's that's actually been in Barnes & Noble.
Right.
Very good.
And what are you working on next? Can you tell us?
Well, I'm about halfway through my next Meg book called Meg Generations, which, you know, will come out in the next 6 months, I think, and hopefully ride the wave of the movie about, you know, December when the trailers start hitting movie theaters.
And that's the Jason Statham movie. Is that kind of like a Jaws situation, pretty much? I need to pick up Meg. I haven't read it, but is that kind of like a Jaws situation?
Yeah, it's like a 70-foot great white shark, prehistoric great white. It weighs about 100,000 pounds. It's a big sucker. And
God, you suck a person right in.
Like Jaws on steroids.
Yeah, really.
To a megalodon, the shark in Jaws was just a snack.
And Jason Statham, that's pretty good. He does a good job. I like his movies. He's got a good energy.
Yeah, he's a great hero actor.
And we're going to go ahead and close out. We got like 2 minutes. That's stevealton.com. Where's the best place to get the books at? Where's the best place?
Well, the quickest place is Amazon. The best place is Barnes & Noble or some independent stores. But if you buy the hardback and you email me, send me your name and bio, and I may make you a character in my next book. So I'm offering you the gift of immortality and a book that I will give a money-back guarantee that you'll love it.
Nice. All right, man. We appreciate it. Really enjoyed the book, and thanks so much, and definitely thanks for talking writing shop with us. I always love doing that with authors. It's always helps a lot. We appreciate it, man.
Well, I appreciate you guys, and hopefully we'll get to do this again sometime.
All right,
keep it in the loop. Keep
take
it
care
in the
of
loop.
Yourself.
Yeehaw. All right, take care. We'll talk at you later. All right, everybody, you're listening to United Public Radio, 107.7 FM, New Orleans. Supernatural Substations coming up next, I guess. Good night, everybody.
Good night. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody. Woo-hoo! Yeehaw! What's up, Fred? Live long and prosper.
Yeah, okay. Wells Fargo, right?
Yeah, Archive's beautiful, actually.
Yeah.